really it is. Everything we do, we point you to Starting Point, which is a lunch that we do together. It's right here. You don't need a special invitation. I'm giving it to you right now. It's after the second service here at Briar Creek, and we'd love to come. Several of the pastors are there, and it's an informal setting just to ask questions and to hear more. So whatever it is, I hope that you will come and you'll check out Starting Point, because that's where it happens. That's why we call it Starting Point. Also this week, it's kind of a sad day. We go through this every year. But as I understand it, this is the last Sunday that we will have most of our college students here. That's correct, isn't it? Most of you guys are, I think Carolina's graduating next week, and maybe Duke, I'm not sure, but I know that, I know Carolina is, because somebody was telling me that this morning. You're in the middle of exams. So when you guys leave, it's kind of like the empty nest syndrome I think parents go through, because we're like, oh, where'd they go? And, you know, I quit having to, it's actually much easier to write messages, because I quit having to check every illustration to make sure it's actually culturally relevant. So there is an upside to it. But we just want to acknowledge you guys, tell you that we miss you. If you're a student at any of our universities or seminary or whatever, would you just stand up right now at both campuses? And would you guys stand up? All right. You guys can sit down, and over there at Coal Mill too, we love you guys, and you make up a major part of our church and part of who we are, and we are very grateful for you all. Next week, I'm not finishing the series this week, so you'll have to check out the website if you want to hear how this whole thing ends, hear about their nasty divorce in the last chapter. No, I'm kidding, that's not what happens. We've been following this couple through Song of Solomon, and last week in chapter 4, the curtain was pulled back and their sex life was exposed. By the way, did y'all see the article in the News and Observer this week about the woman who, for her husband's 40th birthday, the gift that she gave him, did y'all see this? She gave him the gift of having sex with him every day for 365 days for the next year. That was in there. In fact, I was really, as I was reading this article, hoping that somewhere it would be connected to somebody in our church. I was like, that would be great. But no, it happened a year ago, and that couple lives in Charlotte. But the reporter asked them and said, you know, she said, because it's been a year, she said, did you renew it again this year for his 41st birthday? And she was like, no, I gave him a golf club this year. So, yeah, anyway, for the last 2 weeks, we've seen the curtain pulled back and their sex exposed. And I know that some of you are rejoining us now because you took a two-week vacation from this church. So welcome back. But now what we're going to see is we're going to see their first fight exposed. And it's a nasty one, okay? Now, let me tell you here at the very beginning, fighting in a relationship is inevitable. Every relationship, every marriage at least, begins with a honeymoon, which literally means, if you've ever thought about this, a sweet month, honeymoon. And in that time, everything is perfect. But that very quickly gives way to the stage that we call disillusionment. And girls, that's where you figure out that you thought you were marrying Solomon, but you discover he's actually more like Homer Simpson. All right? In this time, all their warts, all their rough edges come out. You find out they are selfish. They have a temper. They smell bad. Right? They have personality quirks and weird habits. There's way too many stories for me to tell you guys this morning, but all these have been cleared by Veronica. When we got married, one of the things we quickly discovered was that both of us hated to answer the phone. That was one of the whole reasons I got married, is so I wouldn't have to answer the phone at our house. The phone would ring, and I'm telling you, we would have a 10-minute argument about who should be answering the phone. The phone quit ringing 10 minutes ago, and we're still standing there, you know, measured out. I was only 10 feet from the phone, and you were 12 feet, so therefore I ought to be, you know, it was terrible. We fixed it by actually getting just cell phones and getting rid of our house phones. So now we know whose fault it is if they don't answer. It's little things for us like, my job is to empty the trash in the house, one of my jobs, and she feels like that part of that is putting a bag in the trash can. I feel like that's a whole separate thing, and she ought to be responsible for that. A lot of surprises. Conflict occurs because two people who previously have lived by themselves, and not to be insulting to you single people, but for the most part for themselves, are now united. And unless you marry somebody that is virgin born, okay, they are going to be selfish, they are going to be annoying, so yes, you are going to fight. And for you starry-eyed engaged people that feel like, we never fight, Right. I don't mean to depress you, but the reason you don't fight, okay, is because your knowledge of each other is still superficial. Because I know you think that you're marrying a perfect angel, but give it about a year and you will think that you married evil incarnate. And though you might not ever consider divorce, I promise you, you will consider homicide at some point, okay? But real love is love through conflict, not the absence of conflict. You ever notice how infatuated people are with the lives of the stars in Hollywood? And they'll talk about them, and they'll say about some big star, and they'll say, oh, what great lovers they are. Well, as we used to say in Yadkinville, hogwash. That is not love at all, because at the first sign of problems, they ditch each other. You show me somebody that has been married long enough to see all the problems and shortcomings in that other person and grows in love with each other anyway, that's real love. So Tommy Nelson says, and I quote, good couples are not couples that don't fight. Good couples are couples that learn to fight fair. Listen, okay? It's usually not what couples are fighting about that destroys the relationship. It's the fact that they don't know how to fight healthily. In fact, if you recall, in chapter 2 of this book, Solomon said, it's the little foxes that destroy the vineyard. The little foxes, not the big ones, because they're there. It's just that we don't know how to handle them, and that's what's devastating. The issues that Veronica and I fight about, I'm telling you, are usually unbelievably small. The other night, it was last week, I come home, and the kids have left some stuff out on the deck, and they've left some stuff out in the garage, and I came home, and I said, Veronica, and I tried to be calm. I was like, it would just really help me out if you would have the kids and you guys would clean up as you go, because that means that the first 30 minutes of me being home means that I don't have to go clean all this stuff up. That's what was my statement to her. And she said, well, why are you telling me? I didn't leave the stuff out. The kids left it out. Why don't you talk to them? I'm like, excuse me, they're 5 and 2. Okay, and I feel like they probably need a home manager because they're that young. They need somebody watching over them. Well, in a minute, this thing, I'm telling you, 30 seconds, this thing has blown out of proportion. And we're now hollering at each other. They are me just being home. And in fact, it ended with Veronica saying to me, she looks at me and she says, well, you're just perfect, aren't you? You great manager, you? It was like the most awkward thing that she has ever said to me. And we both just stared at each other for a minute and then just busted out laughing. But it started out as simply leaving toys out, and it ended up with her being a bad home manager and me being a perfectionist dictator. Okay, because we don't know how to fight it that well. Most marriages that fall apart are not the result of really bad or truly irreconcilable differences. It's because people don't know how to handle conflict in a healthy way. So what I hope that you'll hear first off this morning is that for those of you who in your marriages are in the midst of struggle, or really any relationship that you're in, I will tell you there is hope. I know some of you are in marriages where you're about to give up. But today I want to show you a completely new way of handling conflict. I want you to learn how to fight according to Scripture. I know that sounds weird, but that's exactly what I'm going to show you. All right, because part of that is learning to see your natural response in conflict. Like I mentioned to you at the beginning of this series, some of you are fighters, right? You love. I mean, you just not love it, but you just, I mean, when the fight happens, you're a screamer. You know, you throw stuff. You're aggressive. Some of you are more prone, on the other hand, to flight, which means you don't like to fight. You avoid conflict. You would rather just withdraw and look for little kind of subtle ways to stick it to them. That's kind of who you are. Chances are, as I'll show you today, hopefully, you're going to fit into one of those categories, fight or flight. Like I told you, I'm kind of a combination of those two. I'm a slap and run guy, okay? Song of Solomon chapter 5 is where we're going to pick up here with their first fight, beginning in verse 2. Listen, as I read it to you, I slept, says the girl, but my heart was awake. In other words, she's having sweet dreams, all right? She's in rapid eye movement stage of her sleep. When I heard my lover knocking and calling, open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my perfect one. My head is drenched with dew and my hair with the dampness of the night. Solomon has had a long, hard day at the office. He's now come home to his wife. You see, in those days, men and women often had separate bedchambers. So he's come home late in the evening and he wants to be with her. He wants to cuddle with her. He wants to spoon. He wants to tell her about his problems and have her rub his back and say, it's all okay, baby. right? And then maybe he's hoping for a little pomegranate snack on top of that, right? Commentators point out that the progression of things that he calls her, sister, darling, dove, perfect one, that's a very sexual progression. And so it's very obvious that he just wants to be with her and other stuff, okay? Her response, ladies, verse 3. But I responded, I've taken off my robe. It's almost like that's what I was hoping for. She's like, but it's cold. I don't want to get out of bed. Should I get dressed again? And by the way, I've washed my feet. Should I get them soiled? Okay, first of all, her attitude is, listen, if you can't get home at a decent hour, you should not expect anything from me. Plus, I'm dreaming, okay? And my feet are clean. You see what they're having a fight about? Their first fight is about sex. There are four things that couples fight about most often in the first year of their marriage. And I think this is pretty consistent. All right, here are the big four. They fight about sex, they fight about money, they fight about their extended families, their in-laws, and they fight over their inability to communicate. And so it's very, I think, just very typical that the first fight this couple goes through that Scripture tells you about, shows you how relevant it is over sex. Solomon's response, verse 4, watch this. My lover tried to unlatch the door. You see, in those days, you locked the door from the inside, okay? And so if you had a key, you'd reach it through this little hole they put in the door that was just big enough for a hand, and you'd reach through and put the key in on the other side, and you would unlock it. Solomon doesn't have the key. So what he's done is he's reached through, and he's tried to grab a hold of the latch. What you should notice, okay, and I'll show you, prove this to you in a minute, but take my word for it now. Solomon's response is very calm. He's not yelling. He's not beating the door down. He's not saying, woman, I don't care about how clean your feet are. I'm going to come in and get me a snack of pomegranates. All right? He's not doing that. He just calmly reaches through. And because of that, something happens in her. All right? Continue with verse 4. She says, my heart thrilled within me. I jumped to open the door for my love, and my hands dripped with perfume. My fingers dripped with lovely myrrh as I pulled back the bolt. You see, Solomon has reached through. Now, there's a metaphor here you got to catch. He's reached through and tried to unlock the door. She gets up, and when she gets up and actually grabs hold of the latch that Solomon just touched, her hands get covered in myrrh and perfume that Solomon left. Right? That's a metaphor meaning he left love on the latch. That's what he's saying, is that he responded with love, not with anger to her. It was just dripping with love, and so her heart changes. Verse 6, I opened to my lover, but he was gone. My heart sank. And so I searched for him, but I couldn't find him anywhere. I called to him, but there was no reply. You see, her heart has changed. She's not selfish or angry anymore. Couple things you should notice about Solomon's response. And if you're writing stuff down, this is probably something you should jot down. First of all, as I mentioned, it's a calm response. You see, conflict is often, as I've explained to you before, like a tennis match. Right? The two of you are standing across from each other, and your relationship is you volleying little, you know, love hits back and forth to each other. That's kind of what it is. And all of a sudden, one of you gets a little ticked off, a little feisty about something, and so you put a little tap spin on the ball, and it comes back, and the person's like, oh, yeah? And they hit the ball back, and you gradually get harder and harder as it goes back and forth between each other until you're standing about 2 feet from each other in the net, just killing the ball at each other. And what Solomon explains to you through this story is that sometimes it's best when your spouse puts a little speed on the ball just to let the ball go by. And not respond or not hit back in that way. Okay? In fact, this is a big thing for Solomon. There are just scores of verses, literally, dozens in the book of Proverbs that give this principle. Here are just a sample of them. Proverbs 12:16. The vexation of a fool, says Solomon, is known at once, but the prudent ignores an insult. Just ignores it. Right? A fool is somebody who you can tell as soon as you tick them off, they're responding back, they're hitting the ball back. Proverbs 6:20-21, here's a great picture. Where there is no wood, the fire goes out. Right? Okay, there's nothing, if it's not ticking you off, if you're just saying, hey, look, my wood here is doused with water, you know, your little sparks are not going to set anything off. Proverbs 17:14, the beginning of strife is like releasing water. Therefore, stop contention before a quarrel starts. In other words, he's saying, imagine conflict like water that has begun to stream through a dam. Right? There's an easy way and a hard way to stop the water flow. The easy way is to do it when it's just trickling out. That's when you can repair it. If you wait till the thing is just barreling out of the dam, you probably are not going to be able to stop it any longer. Right? Now, I know what some of you are saying back to this. You're like, but I just want them to know how they're being selfish. If they would just ask for forgiveness, then I would forgive them. And the reason you feel that way is because part of being made in the image of God is that you have a tuning fork inside of you that corresponds to God where you feel injustice. And when you are repaying injustice, you feel nigh unto deity. You feel right, you feel in tune with the universe because you feel like I've got to tell this person where they are wrong. But what Solomon is saying is no. For most of these things, you have to simply let it go. Now, by the way, I know that sometimes you can't. And we're going to talk more about that in a few minutes. Okay? So just hear me out on this. For most of the time, however, it's best just to let it go. And when you do let it go, here's what I would tell you to consider. Think about this. Most of the wrongs that Jesus forgives me of, are they wrongs that I will have admitted to him specifically? I would say no. I mean, I try to confess my sin as God brings them to mind, but chances are when I get to heaven, I'm going to discover that most of my sin, I never actually confessed or acknowledged to God, which means that he forgave me of sins that I never really in the moment even saw as being sin. And that's what you consider is that, yeah, you don't have to have your spouse acknowledge it. Sometimes you just let it go. So his response, first of all, is calm. Secondly, it is graceful. He leaves myrrh on the handles. He's not responding in kind. He's returning good for evil. Paul described it this way, Romans 12:19. Never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God, because it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, and I know it's kind of a stretch to say your enemy is your spouse, but you can apply it, right? If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. For by so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. I've always loved that image, right? Because I thought it was odd. I was like, putting coals on their head. That's exactly what I feel like doing right now anyway. Right? This is not some kind of a passive-aggressive way of sticking it to them. What it means, listen, to put coals of fire in their head means that when you're nice to them, listen, your spouse will most certainly be overwhelmed with the guilt of what they're doing. Coals of fire is like awakening their sense of conscience. That's what Paul is saying. Coals of fire is suddenly waking them up to what they're doing. And in this passage, Solomon's graceful response has awakened her to the selfishness of her own actions and changed her heart. That's why Paul goes on to say at the end of this verse, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. You see, he didn't say do not be overcome by evil, instead be run over by evil. He said, no, the way you defeat evil or selfishness in your spouse is not by returning tit for tat. The way you defeat it is by overcoming it with good. Repaying vengeance, really, honestly, is not going to get you anything. In fact, it usually has the opposite effect of what you want. James Dobson tells a true story, okay? In order for you to get this, you got to understand that this is true. He tells a true story about a man and a woman, married couple, who she had a new dress, and she was really excited about wearing it to work. And so she gets up, puts it on. It's one of those ones that has a zipper in the back, so she asks him to zip it up. So he goes over to it, and he zips it up, and he's feeling a little playful, so he's like, zip, 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 back down, zip, 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 just two or three times, just playing around, breaks the zipper. So now she can't wear her new dress, and that totally ticks her off. So she finds a new dress, another dress, and she goes off to work, and she comes back at the end of the day, and she parks her car in the driveway and notices that her other car is out. She sees her husband's leg sticking out from under the car. Obviously, he's working on it. So she has a great idea. She thinks she walks over to him, grabs his zipper, and goes zip, 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 back and forth. She feels a very smug sense of satisfaction having repaid him, goes back into her house, walks into her kitchen, and there stands her husband. And she's like, what are you doing in here? And he's like, I'm just in my kitchen. She says, no, you're under the car. She says, no. He says, no, that's our neighbor. I got him to help me work on the car. She runs back out there, and the true story, he is knocked out cold. Just completely, knocked out, because he did what any guy would do if you suddenly grab his zipper area unannounced, right? He sat straight up under the car and knocked himself out. Repaying evil for evil. Not going to work. In fact, if you operate on the eye for an eye principle, pretty soon you're both going to be blind. All right, so he's not working. All right, so watch this. Watch where this girl goes next in this story. All right, this gets even better. Verse 7. The night watchmen found me as they made their rounds. They beat and bruised me and stripped off my veil, those watchmen on the walls, those sneaky rascals. They beat me and they bruised me. Now, I know you're like, well, that's kind of harsh. Her getting knocked around by the watchman. You know, I mean, is Solomon happy about this? He's like, aha. Okay, you got to understand how this fits in the poetry. All right, the watchmen on the walls were the guardians of Jerusalem. And they were a Hebrew poetic symbol of the justice of God. Right? They kept God's people safe. And what she is saying is that through their treatment, their harsh treatment of her, God is getting even with her. Not Solomon. Solomon's got nothing to do with this. Solomon would be angry if he knew it. But God, through these guardians, has responded to her. When a spouse responds in love and leaves the judgment to God, then what God does to your spouse is just like what happened to this girl. She is awakened to her own selfishness as her sin is exposed and she feels convicted about that. Does that make sense? Let me make sure that you get this, all right? Listen, there's only two things that can really change your spouse. Only two. One is living out the gospel in front of them, and the other is the power of God working in them and on them. Those are the only two things that can change it. I know you want to try to change them by threatening them and kind of getting a different angle on them and withholding this or yelling at them or making them scared. What? That's not going to work. Only two things actually change their heart. One is living out the grace of Jesus in front of them, and the other one is going to be letting God deal with them, which means that when your spouse hurts you, you don't respond. What you do is you live like Jesus lived, right? And then you pray for them and say, God, I need you to change them. Right? Some of you have such ardent desires to change something about your spouse, and so you punish them and you threaten them, but you can't. It's just not going to work. Now, you're like, well, how do you know this other method work that you're giving me? Well, look at verse 8. Look at what she starts to say. Make this promise, O women of Jerusalem. If you find my lover, tell him I am weak with love. Right? She's changed, not because she's afraid of him, not because she has some sense of duty. It's not even where she's like, all right, I feel guilty now, and I got to be a good, you know, wife, and I want God to be happy with me, or I've got to change because we got to keep our family together so our kids grow up in, you know, a two-parent house. She didn't change for any of those reasons. Notice that her heart is fully saturated with love again, right? Her heart is just, she's grown in more love with him, and then she launches off on this description of him. Look, verse 10, my lover is white and dazzling. White and dazzling, better than 10,000 others. White is a poetic Hebrew reference to his inward purity. His head is the finest gold. And some of you ladies are like, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. My husband's head is full of metal. Right, that's not what she's saying. Gold is a reference to his mind. She thinks of his spotless character, his wisdom. He's not a rash hothead, and that makes him beautiful to her. And so she says, you are more handsome to me than 10,000 other men. His character to her makes him more beautiful than Matthew McConaughey, Brad Pitt, or whatever, right? She's not, because of his reaction, she's not thinking, man, I wish I were married to some other man. She's not sitting around secretly fantasizing about her husband's untimely death the way that husbands, some of your wives, do about you, okay? She's not doing that. What she's doing is thinking, oh, my heart is drawn back to him. His eyes sparkle like doves beside springs of water. They're set like jewels washed in milk. The words sparkle and fitly set are both a reference to how he looks at her. His eyes sparkle towards her. They are fitly set toward her. He doesn't have a wandering eye looking for other women now that she has disappointed him. They're not red and puffy from alcoholism, right? I mean, they are fitly set in grace toward her. Verse 13, his cheeks are like gardens of spices giving off fragrance. His lips are like the lotus perfumed with myrrh. Now, a lot of you guys are probably hearing this and thinking, Solomon's kind of a metro sort of guy, isn't he? What a girly man. No, the bed of spices is a metaphor about his tenderness to her. His lips are like the lotus. The lotus was known for its intoxicating fragrance. She's saying that when we kiss and when we cuddle, I feel firecrackers or see firecrackers. Verse 14, his arms are like rounded bars of gold set with beryl. His body is like bright ivory glowing with lapis lazuli. I don't really know what that is, by the way, okay? Verse 15, actually it's sapphires, I looked it up. Verse 15, his legs are like marble pillars set in sockets of finest gold. His posture is stately, like the noble cedars of Lebanon. She's acknowledging his strength, but it's not a strength that she fears. She admires it because it's a strength that is tender and protecting toward her. So she says, verse 16, his mouth is sweetness itself. He is desirable in every way. Such, O women of Jerusalem, is my lover and my friend. You see, listen. His actions in conflict make her more in love with him. Listen, because there is nothing as compelling and attractive that has the ability to change like grace does. And that's because there's nothing as beautiful as Jesus. Remember, I told you a few weeks ago that when Jesus was here on earth, Isaiah said there was nothing about Jesus physically that would have attracted us to him. Isaiah said he was a very plain, if not ugly looking person, just a normal person. But yet people were attracted to Jesus in droves. Why is that? Because he had an inward beauty. He had an inward beauty that was attractive. You ever wonder why God did not make Jesus his only son on earth, right? Why did God not make Jesus unbelievably good looking? That would make sense to me to show how awesome God is by making a really good looking guy and saying, look how awesome he is. You know the reason I don't think he would have done that? It's because God wanted us to see that real attractive beauty is not something that is on the outside. It's something that comes from within. And that's how Jesus was. Jesus' grace made him beautiful, and that's what attracted us to him, and ultimately his grace is what changes us. You see, listen, grace is what changes your spouse. Here's a deep thought for you. You ready? When your spouse changes because you've threatened them, what's motivating their change is fear. And to not do something because you are afraid is still another way of living with self-interest. You see that? That's kind of a deep thought. When I'm not doing something because I'm afraid of your reaction, I'm still just living with self-interest. What really needs to happen is your spouse needs to start thinking of someone besides him or herself, right? And how does that happen? It happens as you live out grace in front of them. This is the great gospel secret that nobody gets, and that is that grace, not the law, changes. That means if you really want to cure the racist, you don't threaten him with the law. The way you cure the racist is to show him that Christ accepted him when he was an outsider. If you really want to cure the stingy person, it's not by making them feel guilty about not giving money. The way that you cure the stingy person is to show them what Christ has done for them, and then they respond having seen the grace in action. You want to change a self-centered spouse, you have to show them and let them learn about Jesus. And how do you have them learn about Jesus? Not by playing sermons all the time around the house, just, you know, listen to this. The way that you do it is by living out the gospel in front of them. So here's the question. How do you react when your spouse hurts you? At the risk of being a little simplistic, I will tell you there are three basic styles of conflict. All right? A little simplistic, but they're aggressive, passive, and passive-aggressive. All right? Aggressive people. In conflict, they respond by taking it up a notch. They yell, they nag, they scream, they throw stuff. How many of you would classify yourself as the aggressive type? Just be honest. This is how you respond. All right, we got a few honest people and a bunch of you are lying. All right, number two, there's the passive type. And that is you just take it and take it and take it and take it. But you take it for a long time and then one of a few things happens. All right, you take it long enough that you suddenly snap, go postal and shove your spouse into a wood chipper. All right? Or you have an affair, and you serve him a divorce of some kind. Right? Some of you, especially if you're a good Christian, you'll never come even to divorce or an affair. Your sense of duty won't let you do that, or maybe you'll stay together for the kids, but what you'll end up doing is passively taking it and withdrawing into kind of a business relationship marriage where you both just learn to survive. You get along. There's not open hostility in your home, but it doesn't resemble a godly relationship at all. Right, because you're not achieving intimacy, you've just learned to kind of forge out an area, and you're like, we're going to stay together because we don't want to feel guilty, we don't want to get divorced, and we want to stay together for the kids, but you're not achieving intimacy, and that's not what he's talking about. I'll be honest with you, this is where Veronica and I tend to fall. Neither of us are really aggressive, neither of us are yellers or screamers, and what we'll do is we'll just ignore the conflict until there's a growing distance between us, and we're just like two people living in a house. That's when somebody's passive, that's how they respond to conflict. Right? Then there's the combination of those, and this is the sneaky one. They're the passive-aggressive. They're more subtle in how they do it, but, you know, like I'll give you a few examples. They freeze the person out. You know, I'm just not going to talk to you. At least I'm not yelling at them, you think, right? It's actually a way of getting vengeance. When you freeze somebody out, it's a way of getting vengeance like God does. Right? What does God do to sin? He turns his face away from it, And what you're saying to your spouse is, you're not worthy of a relationship with me, so I'm turning my face away from you. I'm God. Ah. Right? That's what you're saying. Another way, you know, people do this is they withhold sex. Right? Oh, come on now. Don't sit there like you don't know what I'm talking about. A woman loses a fight, and she says, fine. Enjoy your victory, Friar George. You know? Or how about this one? Crying. I'll just respond by crying. I'll let John Piper address this one for us. He says, quote, it may come out in tears that look more like hurt, but the heart has learned that this may be the only way to really hurt back. It may come out of silence because we've resolved not to fight. It may show up in picky criticism and relentless correction. It may strike out at persons that have nothing to do with its origin. Right? Like your spouse's parents. There's your problem right there. The womb from which you sprung. That's it, okay? It will feel warranted in its actions by how wrongly it has been treated. All these reactions, aggressive, passive, and passive-aggressive, are all ways of repaying evil for evil. But you see, the Bible way is different. The best way this was ever described was Jesus when he gave us the concept of turning the other cheek. I'm going to do this quickly, okay, because I've been over this before with you. All right? Jesus said that when you were insulted, you were to turn the other cheek. And a lot of people don't get that. They're like, well, I mean, somebody's attacking me, and I'm just like, you know, up. I'm still standing. You know, hit me again. I can take it. You know, you don't. That's not what he's talking about. All right? No martial arts textbook I've ever seen, which is not that many, but no martial arts textbook I've ever seen says that the cheek is the way that you really try to hurt somebody or kill them. Jesus is not saying when you're physically attacked, he's using a metaphor, right? In Jewish thought, the cheek was the relationship. It was the way that you related to somebody. If you were a guy, if you went up to another guy, you would kiss them on the cheek. So to smack somebody's cheek is like turning your back on the relationship. And Jesus says, okay, here's your possible responses. You can go back after their cheek. You smack their cheek back. The other response is to turn to them the same cheek, which is to keep taking it. He says, no. You have to turn the other cheek, which means you try to reestablish the relationship with them. Which means sometimes, yes, you have to confront the evil in them. Right? Jesus was always getting angry. It's not like you never get angry if you're a godly person. I mean, think about it. Jesus got angry at hypocrisy. He got angry at people being stingy. He got angry at any number of things. But when he got angry, it was an anger that arose out of love, not because of a wounded ego. It wasn't that I've got to vindicate my cheek. It was I'm turning myself to you to try to reestablish this relationship. You say, well, how do I know when I'm not angry for personal reasons and when my anger is based on love? Right? Well, you need to take some time and cool down and ask yourself a couple questions. You ask yourself, whose hurt am I actually concerned about here? Is it God's or is it that person's or is it my own? Right? If it's your own, then you're not doing it right. But you may have to confront the evil in them for their sake or your family's sake or God's sake. Or you ask yourself, is this something that will do significant, lasting damage to our relationship? I mean, maybe there's a way that they talk to you that is harmful. It's disrespectful. Maybe it's a bad habit they have. Maybe they're chronically late or they leave their clothes out everywhere. Maybe it's that they're perpetually thinking of their own interests and not your kids. And what you have to say to them is, look, I love you and I love our relationship too much to let this damage our relationship. I can't demand that you change, but I'm going to confront the evil in you and I'm going to return my face to you and say I want to reestablish the relationship. And you get this, it's a little difficult, but you following this? Kind of nod your head, even if you don't, so I can move on, okay? This is entirely opposite of how the world responds in anger. The world responds with personal revenge, a wounded ego. And when Jesus says turn the other cheek, what he's saying is go after the person. Overcome the evil. Confront it. But do so without the slightest drop of malice or rancor. Because you don't care about your face, you care about the person. Try and reestablish the relationship. You're like, well, what if they don't listen? What if they just, you know, what if I do this and they don't? Then at that point, you live out the gospel. And you think and you remember the myriad ways that Jesus has accepted you, and you accept them in the same way. You remember all the sins that you have never acknowledged to Jesus that he's forgiven you of, and then you leave him to God. You're like, but that's so hard. Yes, I understand. That's exactly why Hebrews says, consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. You're supposed to think about what you have done to Jesus. There's a little phrase that has been the salvation of mine and Veronica's relationship. It is the phrase, first sinner, second sinned against. First sinner, second sinned against. And that is where I begin to realize, because you see, what I do is I really can see the ways that Veronica sins. I mean, I hate to tell you this, but I live with her. Nobody knows her sin better than me. And so I see that. I'm living with her, and I have a tendency to think I am sinned against, I am wounded, and I sit around full sorry for myself. But you know what changed that is when I realize the way that Jesus sees me, the way that I sin. I've been forgiven of much more than I will ever personally forgive Veronica of. I am first the sinner and only secondly sinned against. And I can forgive her out of the grace that has been given to me. That's why Hebrews says that. Consider Jesus and think about his massive grace to you. And when you do, then forgiving your spouse becomes completely different. That's why in just a minute, we're going to take communion together. We're going to take communion because we're going to remember that the basis of our relationship is Jesus. But before I get to that, I got to make one final point, and I got to do it quickly, okay? So listen. Chapter 6 opens up like this. Where is your lover gone, O woman of rare beauty? Which way did he turn so he can help you find him? Watch this, watch. This is very important. My lover has gone down to his garden, to his spice beds, to feed his flock in the gardens and to gather the lilies. I am my lover's and my lover is mine. He feeds his flock among the lilies. What does she know about him? She knows he's not out with another woman. She knows that his way of responding to their fight is not to run away or threaten to leave her. She knows, listen, his character. He's feeding his flocks. He's going about his life. She knows where she can find him. Tommy Nelson says, Book of Romance, listen, regardless of the conflict they had, regardless of their spat, their argument, their difference of opinion, their momentary display of bad behavior, they were committed to having an us relationship. And she knows that. They were one. Many things, he says, can be done in virtually every marriage to bring about reconciliation. But the bottom line of all of them is this: a desire to see the relationship reconciled and restored to a deep level of love. Unless there is a desire to reconcile, no reconciliation can occur. If both parties have a deep desire to reconcile, reconciliation is nearly always possible. Sometimes one spouse will need to abandon rights in order to renew or restore the relationship. Each spouse must recognize that individual rights within a marriage are never more important than the unity and love of the relationship as a whole. I will tell you this as a pastor, okay? I have never seen a relationship where both parties were willing to reconcile that didn't work out. I've never seen one. It's almost always that one of the other or the other partners refuses to reconcile. What I'm telling you is if you decide to reconcile, it will happen. Maybe you can find an exception to that, but I'm just telling you, I've never seen one. And listen, where does that desire to reconcile come from? It comes from your commitment and your understanding of God. Which is why for some of you, when you choose to leave your spouse, you think you're choosing between your spouse and freedom. You're saying, I can't stay with them because I don't love them anymore. But what you're really doing is choosing between God and no God. And what you're saying is, I love my freedom more than I love God. What Solomon has is a character that says, yeah, I'm sticking with this thing. I'm committed to an us relationship, and we will find reconciliation. When there is that decision, then you will find a way to reconcile. All right, and where does it come from? Again, this is why we're going into communion. Ephesians 4, 31 and 32. Be kind one to another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another. Or I think it's the way the message says it. Get rid of all bitterness, rage, anger, harsh words, slander, as well as all types of evil behavior. Be kind with one another, sensitive. Forgive one another as quickly and thoroughly as God in Christ forgave you. You see, y'all, it's the gospel. It's the gospel that gives you the ability to love. That's what I've been saying every week. The gospel is the basis of your relationship. And that's why I tell you again, even before we go into this time of communion, before we go in to remember the Lord's Supper, for some of you, listen, what's wrong with your marriage? What's wrong with your life? It's not that you got a bad spouse. Not that you're single. It's not that you're divorced. That's not what's wrong. What's wrong is that you've never learned to love like God loves because you've never learned how God loves you. And what I am begging you to do is to not walk out of this church with a to-do list of ways to fix your marriage because it's not what you need. What I am pleading with you to do is to get your mind around the love that God has given to you and let that change you. As I'll show you in the next time we talk, This is what undergirds all of Song of Solomon, is God's great love for us. At both of our campuses, we're going to have our teams begin to come. They're going to begin to serve the elements. Now, I want to explain this to you as they come. Okay, and you guys go ahead and come on here. I want to explain to you that we do this as a church. We try to do it fairly often to remember God's grace toward us, because it's the basis of everything. If you're not a believer in here, I want you to understand that this is kind of like something we do in the family. This is not really for you. I don't want you to feel excluded. Because what I want you to see is that this bread and this cup is given to you as a symbol. Don't take it yourself. But maybe you should, for the first time, open up your heart to receive Christ. Okay? Maybe you should say, it's not the symbol, not the bread and the cup. What I need is the love of Jesus. And right now, as others are taking this element, you listen right to me, okay? If you are not sure that you know God and that if you died, you would spend eternity with Him, right now, I want you to say something to God like this. God, I don't know if I've ever received your free grace and love. I don't know if I've ever turned over control of my life to you. And right now, I see what I need. And so I give myself to you. We call that receiving Christ. We call it being born again. And that's my invitation to you. Receive Christ. Surrender your life to Him. Receive His love. And be forever changed. Okay, our teams are come. They'll come at both campuses. You listen as you worship, you hold those elements, and I'll lead you through it here in just a moment.